committee has met and resolved the impasse in the following way. Professor Hill indicated on the telephone that she was prepared to have her statement released. And in further discussion with the committee and others involved, it has been determined that we will excuse temporarily Judge Thomas, and we will call momentarily as the witness Anita Hill. Anita Hill will be sworn and make her own statement in her own words, at which time we would then begin the questioning of Professor Hill, after which we will bring back Judge Thomas for questioning. Now the committee will stand in recess until, and I imagine it's only momentarily, as a professor will be here momentarily, but we'll stand in recess until she is able to take her seat, which should be a matter of a minute or so. So that she can come down.
So another pause in the committee's proceedings, a change in the battle plan. Anita Hill will now be taking the witness chair following the testimony by Clarence Thomas. Ms. Hill will now tell her version of her relationship and the events surrounding the controversy. There are huge crowds here at the Capitol today for this proceeding. And as we indicated earlier, the committee met for long hours yesterday to try to work out the work rules, as they were, for proceeding with this testimony. And you get the impression that they're flying by the seat of their pants to a large extent. The Democratic senators and the Republican senators, this is a 14-member committee, 8 Democrats, 6 Republicans. But the chief questioners will be from 2 panels that have been designated as the leading questioners. On the Democratic side, Senators Howell Heflin of Alabama and Patrick Leahy of Vermont. And on the Republican side, there will be questions primarily from Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania and Orrin Hatch from Idaho. This does not mean that other senators can't come in with questions, but they will be the principal questioners. And this is designed to speed the process along. We've been told there will be additional witnesses, supporting witnesses for both Judge Thomas and for Anita Hill. We're not certain now when they will be taking the witness chair.
Because that's where she's coming through.
Lots of little huddles now taking place at the head of the table, involving Chairman Biden and various senators. The committee's action is really in the form of a special inquiry. The panel does not plan to take another vote on whether to recommend confirmation of Judge Thomas. Presumably, once the hearings are over, there will still be a vote on the Senate floor on the nomination, and that is scheduled for next Tuesday at 6 p.m. But that, of course, is contingent upon what happens during these drama at this extraordinary hearing. Nina, you're inside the hearing room now. Anita Hill has not appeared, I presume.
No, she has not, Paul. They are keeping the door pretty much closed. It took heaven and earth for me to get in here because they've got it pretty barricaded. The room is packed, wall to wall, standing room only. There are lots of friends of the nominees here and some friends of Anita Hill. Some of the women members of Congress are here. It's a really quite a sight as we sit here waiting for Anita Hill, the star witness, I guess, and accuser of Judge Thomas, to arrive here. And
Ms. Hill flew into town yesterday from Oklahoma City. We don't know whether she'll have a statement or not, as Judge Thomas did.
I think probably, Paul, that one of the reasons that she did not want to be questioned about her affidavit, I guess, before she testified, or she did not want Judge Thomas questioned, was that she wanted to be able to make her story, make her statement completely before the committee, and to be questioned about it, or at least to have it presented to the public. We don't really know exactly how we're going to proceed here. I suppose it's possible that we could have essentially opening statements from both and then cross-examination of both. Or it is, as yes. I said, there are no rules of evidence here. This isn't a court of law. This is a political event. It may be a search for the truth, but it's also a political event.
Politics certainly has colored this hearing, but then politics usually colors hearings devoted to the nomination process. This has been one terrific week of drama and political jousting here in the Senate, and it all began over the weekend, last weekend, and then it built on Tuesday as the Senate was moving toward a vote on the nomination. It was scheduled to vote at 6 p.m. last Tuesday, and all during that day, one could feel the pressure building against the vote as the country learned more about the harassment charges directed against Judge Thomas. The senator's office deluged with phone calls from women primarily asking for a postponement of the vote, with protests taking place in and around the Capitol. And finally, it appeared there just might not be sufficient votes for Judge Thomas to win confirmation, at which point the Republicans, who were all for Judge Thomas, agreed to postpone the vote so this special hearing could take place.
Paul, while we wait, maybe we should recap some of the things that Judge Thomas said. And I'll go through my notes and you go through yours. He said that he had first heard about Professor Hill's allegation on September 25th when he got a visit from the FBI. He said that that he's been racking his brain ever since and, quote, eating my insides out, trying to figure out what she might have thought, what he might have done to make her make such an allegation. And he categorically denied all allegations. He said he had denied to the FBI originally ever having asked her out or having done anything other than anything improper or making any comments to her other than professional comments. He said that when they were at the Department of Education and he moved to the EEOC, she had been free to remain at the Department of Education, and instead that she chose to go with him. That, I think, is the gavel, and Chairman Biden.
The senator is awaiting her arrival.
It's so crowded in here, Paul, that believe it or not, you can't see. I literally, who am sitting just a few feet from the dais, cannot see everything that's going on. Everybody's standing up. It's a very wild scene.
Well, I'll be your eyes then, Nina, because I can watch on the television monitor right outside the hearing room. The senators are just engaged in small talk, sitting at the head table. The testimony of Clarence Thomas was noteworthy in several respects, as I saw it, Nina. For one of the things he said was that he found it troubling that she had never raised the issue of sexual harassment with other people in the office, not to mention Thomas himself. And he found this so unusual because he said that he thought he'd had a good relationship with her, that this was someone that he had tried to help at every turn in the road. And furthermore, he said that he had always strongly condemned sexual harassment. Whenever it reared its ugly head, as he put it, he spoke out against it. And in fact, others who worked at the EEOC have supported Thomas's advocacy of strong action against sexual harassment. Ms. Hill is now approaching the hearing room, and she'll be entering to take her seat at the hearing at the witness table. She's now coming into the room. Anita Hill, the young woman who brought this allegation of sexual harassment against Judge Clarence Thomas. Accompanied by Capitol Hill police and other Capitol Hill aides, and her friends as well.
Also with her, I believe, are her parents and two brothers. She is the youngest of 13 children, Paul. She was raised on a farm in Oklahoma in poverty, as she says. She went to college, then to Yale Law School, just like Clarence Thomas, graduated from Yale, moved on to a law firm here in Washington, but wanted to go into government service, and went to work for Clarence Thomas at the Department of Education. Here's Chairman Biden.
Your family and others are being seated. In a moment, I will ask you to stand to be sworn, at which time, when that is finished, we will invite you to make any statement that you wish to make. And then what we will do is I will begin by asking you some questions, and then Senator Spector will ask you some questions, and then Senator Leahy will ask you some questions, and then I assume it will be Senator Spector again, but I am not certain of that, will ask you questions. Again, welcome. We're happy that you are here, and let us stand and be sworn, if you will. Professor, do you swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you. Professor Hill, please make whatever statement you would wish to make to the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Excuse me, friend. I instruct the officers, do not let anyone in or out of that door while Professor Hill is making her statement.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thurman, members of the committee, my name is Anita F. Hill, and I am a professor of law at the University of Oklahoma. I was born on a farm in Okmulgee County, Oklahoma, in 1956. I am the youngest of 13 children. I had my early education in Okmulgee County. My father, Albert Hill, is a farmer in that area. My mother's name is Irma Hill. She is also a farmer and a housewife. My childhood was one of a lot of hard work and not much money, but it was one of solid family affection as represented by my parents. I was reared in a religious atmosphere in the Baptist faith, and I have been a member of the Antioch Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, since 1983. It is a very warm part of my life at the present time. For my undergraduate work, I went to Oklahoma State University and graduated from there in 1977. I am attaching to this statement a copy of my resume for further details of my education. Thank you. I graduated from the university with academic honors and proceeded to the Yale Law School, where I received my JD degree in 1980. Upon graduation from law school, I became a practicing lawyer with the Washington, D.C. firm of Wald, Hargrader, and Ross. In 1981, I was introduced to now Judge Thomas by a mutual friend. Judge Thomas told me that he was anticipating a political appointment, and he asked if I would be interested in working with him. He was, in fact, appointed as Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights. After he had taken that post, he asked if I would become his assistant, and I accepted that position. In my early period there, I had two major projects. The first was an article I wrote for Judge Thomas's signature on the education of minority students. The second was the organization of a seminar on high-risk students, which was abandoned because Judge Thomas transferred to the EEOC, where he became the chairman of that office. During this period at the Department of Education, my working relationship with Judge Thomas was positive. I had a good deal of responsibility and independence. I thought he respected my work and that he trusted my judgment. After approximately 3 months of working there, he asked me to go out socially with him. What happened next and telling the world about it are the two most difficult experiences of my life. It is only after a great deal of agonizing consideration and a great number of sleepless nights that I am able to talk of these unpleasant matters to anyone but my close friends. I declined the invitation to go out socially with him and explained to him that I thought it would jeopardize at the time I considered to be a very good working relationship. I had a normal social life with other men outside of the office. I believed then, as now, that having a social relationship with a person who was supervising my work would be ill-advised. I was very uncomfortable with the idea and told him so. I thought that by saying no and explaining my reasons, my employer would abandon his social suggestions. However, to my regret, in the following few weeks, he continued to ask me out on several occasions. He pressed me to justify my reasons for saying no to him. These incidents took place in his office or mine. They were in the form of private conversations, which would not have been overheard by anyone else. My working relationship became even more strained when Judge Thomas began to use work situations to discuss sex. On these occasions, he would call me into his office for reports on education issues and projects, or he might suggest that because of the time pressures of his schedule, we go to lunch to a government cafeteria. After a brief discussion of work, he would turn the conversation to a discussion of sexual matters. His conversations were very vivid. He spoke about acts that he had seen in pornographic films involving such matters as women having sex with animals and films showing group sex or rape scenes. He talked about pornographic materials depicting individuals with large penises or large breasts involved in various sex acts. On several occasions, Thomas told me graphically of his own sexual prowess. Because I was extremely uncomfortable talking about sex with him at all, and particularly in such a graphic way, I told him that I did not want to talk about these subjects. I would also try to change the subject to education matters or to non-sexual personal matters, such as his background or his beliefs. My efforts to change the subject were rarely successful. Throughout the period of these conversations, he also from time to time asked me for social engagement. My reaction to these conversations was to avoid them by eliminating opportunities for us to engage in extended conversations. This was difficult because at the time I was his only assistant at the Office of Education, or Office for Civil Rights. During the latter part of my time at the Department of Education, the social pressures and any conversation of his offensive behavior ended. I began both to believe and hope that our working relationship could be a proper, cordial, and professional one. When Judge Thomas was made chair of the EEOC, I needed to face the question of whether to go with him. I was asked to do so, and I did. The work itself was interesting, and at that time it appeared that the sexual overtures which had so troubled me had ended. I also faced the realistic fact that I had no alternative job. While I might have gone back to private practice, perhaps in my old firm or at another, I was dedicated to civil rights work, and my first choice was to be in that field. Moreover, at that time, the Department of Education itself was a dubious venture. President Reagan was seeking to abolish the entire department. For my first months at the EEOC, where I continued to be an assistant to Judge Thomas, there were no sexual conversations or overtures. However, during the fall and winter of 1982, these began again. The comments were random and ranged from pressing me about why I didn't go out with him to remarks about my personal appearance. I remember his saying that someday I would have to tell him the real reason that I wouldn't go out with him. He began to show displeasure in his tone and voice and his demeanor, and his continued pressure for an explanation. He commented on what I was wearing in terms of whether it made me more or less sexually attractive. The incidents occurred in his inner office at the EEOC. One of the oddest episodes I remember was an occasion in which Thomas was drinking a Coke in his office. He got up from the table at which we were working, went over to his desk to get the Coke, looked at the can and asked, "Who has put pubic hair on my Coke?" On other occasions, he referred to the size of his own penis as being larger than normal, and he also spoke on some occasions of the pleasures he had given to women with oral sex. At this point, late 1982, I began to feel severe stress on the job. I began to be concerned that Clarence Thomas might take out his anger with me by degrading me or not giving me important assignments. I also thought that he might find an excuse for dismissing me. In January of 1983, I began looking for another job. I was handicapped because I feared that if he found out, he might make it difficult for me to find other employment, and I might be dismissed from the job I had. Another factor that made my search more difficult was that there was a period, this was during a period of a hiring freeze in the government. In February 1983, I was hospitalized for 5 days on an emergency basis for acute stomach pain, which I attributed to stress on the job. Once out of the hospital, I became more committed to find other employment and sought further to minimize my contact with Thomas. This became easier when Allison Duncan became office director, because most of my work was then funneled through her and I had contact with Clarence Thomas mostly in staff meetings. In the spring of 1983, an opportunity to teach at Oral Roberts University opened up. I participated in a seminar, taught an afternoon session in a seminar at Oral Roberts University. The dean of the university saw me teaching and inquired as to whether I would be interested in furthering, pursuing a career in teaching, beginning at Oral Roberts University. I agreed to take the job in large part because of my desire to escape the pressures I felt at the EEOC due to Judge Thomas. When I informed him that I was leaving in July, I recall that his response was that now I would no longer have an excuse for not going out with him. I told him that I still preferred not to do so. At some time after that meeting, he asked if he could take me to dinner at the end of the term. When I declined, he assured me that the dinner was a professional courtesy only and not a social invitation. I reluctantly agreed to accept that invitation, but only if it was at the very end of a working day. On, as I recall, the last day of my employment at the EEOC in the summer of 1983, I did have dinner with Clarence Thomas. We went directly from work to a restaurant near the office. We talked about the work I had done, both at education and at the EEOC. He told me that he was pleased with all of it, except for an article and speech that I had done for him while we were at the Office for Civil Rights. Finally, he made a comment that I will vividly remember. He said that if I ever told anyone of his behavior, that it would ruin his career. This was not an apology, nor was it an explanation. That was his last remark about the possibility of our going out or reference to his behavior. In July of 1983, I left Washington, D.C. area and have had minimal contacts with Judge Clarence Thomas since. I am, of course, aware from the press that some questions have been raised about conversations I had with Judge Clarence Thomas after I left the EEOC. From 1983 until today, I have seen Judge Thomas only twice. On one occasion, I needed to get a reference from him, and on another, he made a public appearance in Tulsa. On one occasion, he called me at home, and we had an inconsequential conversation. On one occasion, he called me without reaching me, and I returned the call without reaching him, and nothing came of it. I have, on at least three occasions, been asked to ask as a conduit to him for others. I knew his secretary, Diane Holt. We had worked together at both EEOC and education. There were occasions in which I spoke to her, and on some of these occasions, undoubtedly, I passed on some casual comment to then-Chairman Thomas. There were a series of calls in the first 3 months of 1985, occasioned by a group in Tulsa, which wished to have a civil rights conference. They wanted Judge Thomas to be the speaker and enlisted my assistance for this purpose. I did call in January and February to no effect, and finally suggested to the person directly involved, Susan Cahall, that she put the matter into her own hands and call directly. She did so in March of 1985. In connection with that March invitation, Ms. Cahall wanted conference materials for the seminar, and some research was needed. I was asked to try to get the information and did attempt to do so. There was another call about another possible conference in the July of 1985. In August of 1987, I was in Washington, D.C., and I did call Diane Holt. In the course of this conversation, she asked me how long I was going to be in town, and I told her. It is recorded in the message as August 15th. It was, in fact, August 20th. She told me about Judge Thomas's marriage, and I did say congratulate him. It is only after a great deal of agonizing consideration that I am able to talk of these unpleasant matters to anyone except my closest friends. As I've said before, these last few days have been very trying and very hard for me. And it hasn't just been the last few days this week. It has actually been over a month now that I have been under the strain of this issue. Telling the world is the most difficult experience of my life, but it is very close to having to live through the experience that occasioned this meeting. I may have used poor judgment early on in my relationship with this issue. I was aware, however, that telling at any point in my career could adversely affect my future career. And I did not want, early on, to burn all the bridges to the EEOC. As I said, I may have used poor judgment. Perhaps I should have taken angry or even militant steps, both when I was in the agency or after I left it. But I must confess to the world that the course that I took seemed the better as well as the easier approach. I declined any comment to newspapers, but later when Senate staff asked me about these matters, I felt I had a duty to report. I have no personal vendetta against Clarence Thomas. I seek only to provide the committee with information which it may regard as relevant. It would have been more comfortable to remain silent. It took no initiative to inform anyone. I took no initiative to inform anyone. But when I was asked by a representative of this committee to report my experience, I felt that I had to tell the truth. I could not keep silent.
Judge, thank you very much.